right. I'm your host, Soli, and welcoming to the show is Ryan Pock of Soundtrack Your Life. We're getting into another intense music composer study, and welcome, sir.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
All right. Tonight's subject is none other than Alexandre Desplat. We have probably know him best for his basically, you know, coming from France to America and various award-winning compositions, including Grand Budapest Hotel, The Shape of Water, The Midnight Sky, 2019's Little Women, The Girl with the Pearl Earring, The Queen, and then following it up with some Harry Potter sequels, Fantastic Mr. Fox, and some Tom Hopper collaborations, including King's Speech, as well as once again and The Danish Girl, and just numerous other just moments where it's like, yeah, I can totally understand why he's working on this material.
Yeah, and he just did Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio.
Also, there you go. So he's sticking with whoever he's worked with before. He's not giving up on
it. Yeah, I find that a lot with directors. You know, they kind of find their composer of choice. Like, I found out about Alexander probably because I'm a big Wes Anderson fan.
Yes, there you go.
And he took over starting with Fantastic Mr. Fox, and he's been doing every Wes Anderson film since then.
He's pretty much his go-to now. What's funny is I'm not sure who was it. I thought for whatever reason it was Silvestri or James Horner who worked with Anderson, but he often picked a lot of indie bands.
It was Mother's Ball.
Oh, okay. So now he took over and he's been doing a lot of his stop motion animations. I definitely recall the Moonrise Kingdom one being a little atmospheric.
Yeah.
Other ones Desplat has done has included 2011's A Better Life, A Therapy, Argo, Syriana is a big one I know, Cherie, Julie and Julia, Tamara Drew, Rise of the Guardians for DreamWorks, Zero Dark Thirty, and I definitely actually heard The Monuments Men and 2014's Godzilla score and Imitation Game before those were out. But yeah, 2014 and 13 seemed like he really peaked there. He had Venus and Fur, Philomena, Unbroken, Zulu, which is a South African procedural with Orlando Bloom and Forest Whitaker, that's criminally underseen, Valerian, Isles of Dogs, Operation Finale, even any of these movies that anyone might not be familiar with or might not know every single score, it's still like the minute you see the town involved and just kind of he pretty much has two modes. He goes for a fantasy world or he goes for like a period piece drama.
Yeah. I mean, his music really works with like kind of the period piece sort of a vibe.
Yeah, I couldn't really find as much on like who mentored him and everything other than that he just kept picking Brent minds and he kept kind of just working on so many internationally renowned pictures. And it seemed like around 07, 08, that seemed like that was a big year for him. He worked on Lush Caution, Mr. Montgomery's Wonder Emporium, and Golden Compass. And it seemed like there he was kind of going in between just popcorn kids movies and then, you know, Oscar bait movies and then just art house galore. But I saw that he, like many of these guys, he heard Bernard Herrmann's soundtracks for Hitchcock movies, and then of course heard the immortal George Williams Star Wars theme, and then from that point on he studied Nino Roto, Maurice Jarre, and Georges Delarue, who have, you know, again done all sorts of European cinema, and he just decided that's where I want to go.
Yeah, so for a little bit over 10 years he was doing only European films, and then in 2005 he did Syriana, and from there he was able to kind of get his foot in the door in Hollywood.
The George Clooney card. Yeah.
And, yeah.
But altogether, he just seems, he reminds me a little of Graham Revell in terms of he kind of goes, you know, in, instead of going, I know a lot of people praise Hans Zimmer as well as make fun of how he reuses a lot of his same material nowadays. He knows it like No Tomorrow, to where he can kind of, I don't want to sound like I'm talking smack, but like if he were to phone it in, he'd still get the job done. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And Desplat, I don't really ever know what he's going for, because he seems to use all sorts of just uncanny orchestras and even unusual bass and violins. I saw another French movie he did called The Nest, which was basically France's answer to Die Hard, Assault on Precinct 13 type blockbusters. And that's funny, is I just found that interesting, because that's kind of a fun, straightforward shoot 'em up. But I remember, I think when I thought about it real hard, I was like, you know, I don't remember any shots from it, but I definitely remember the moody soundtrack, which is exactly what it needed.
Yeah.
And
I like what he does with the piano a lot. I think most people just assume when you hear a piano and a score, it's going to kind of take the lead and everything else is going to kind of back it up. But a lot of times he'll use a piano kind of as just another instrument in the orchestra. And I find that really,
it's really soothing, but like, yeah, you say, it's not, it doesn't, he somehow is able to risk being, yeah, like too over the top. He's able to avoid being melodramatic or even just predictable. Like, he doesn't even use the same kind of cues for a lot of these World War II and spy period movies that he's done. Even some of these animated movies like Secret Life of Pets 2, I actually do know that score a bit, because it used to be on at every other, movies like that are often playing at doctors' clinics and everything.
Yep. Yep. And
so I've seen parts of it, but it is funny how, like, with even just some better known movies like the Sisters Brothers and the French Dispatch, it's interesting to me how he's kind of, he's able to be very quiet without feeling like, you know, you're waiting for the next music cue.
Yeah, there's a lot of melody in his music, but it's not really like in your face.
Yeah.
You know, he loves John Williams, but it doesn't have that same sort of like, oh, this is a John Williams score.
Oh, man. Yeah, that is true. He doesn't. And for someone who was influenced by him and Herman, it doesn't seem like he's trying to lean in too heavy on any of it. And I've surprisingly seen a huge ton of these movies, which is funny, because usually when you see a composer, you either know them because they've stuck with a lot of the same writers and directors, or at just a certain period, they were getting a lot of work or whatever, what have you. And it's like with him, he's somehow been able to change it up a lot. Like, you're seeing all these other names like Lars Hallström, Richard Lacrane, Jonathan Glazer, even David Yates. And even though we mainly are mentioning Hopper, Malick, Clooney, and even Bigelow, he's actually got a lot of collaborations with Wim Wenders and Polanski, even, you know, so it's interesting seeing how he's kind of a go-to for a mixture of crowd-pleasing movies as well as more art house limited theaters. So it is just such a rarity, I think, because for whatever reason, a lot of people like to kind of stick with only a particular kind of blockbuster franchise or only particular kinds of Oscar award-winning movies. He seems to kind of know instantly if it's some movie which has to capture a certain period, I'm game. Like,
Yeah, and he can switch it up. You know, he's done like a Twilight movie, and he's also done like The Shape of Water, which, you know, are pretty different. Obviously, yeah. He's done a couple Harry Potter films.
He seems to just be loyal to that filmmaker, so he doesn't really care. I mean, yeah, with he pretty much was loyal to Chris Weitz, and Weitz ended up, you know, doing a Twilight sequel, so he didn't. Yeah, he was okay with it, but yeah, I'm seeing some other French and Aussie kind of movies as well, where it's like, man, I would like to know the process of how he just like goes around and, you know, finds all these kinds of projects.
Yeah, and I read that he was originally slated to do Star Wars Rogue One, but he had to drop out because of a scheduling conflict. And I really wish I could have heard what it would sound like for him to do a Star Wars movie.
Yeah, I mean, there's still time. I'm really surprised he hasn't broken out into TV.
Yeah, that's true. But I guess Ludwig's got a chokehold on, you know, the Mandalorian.
That's right. It is Ludwig. I thought it was Giacchino for whatever reason. Yeah. But yeah, Ludwig Göransson. Yeah. Yeah. He did compose it. But all together, I mean, just trying to think how I would describe his tone, because some of these other movies I've seen on here, like, surprisingly, the HBO drama, This Special Relationship, which talks about the political overseeing and professional friendship of Tony Blair and Bill Clinton in this one political thriller. It's, again, you know, he's doing all these everyday kind of dramas, and yet he's somehow, it's like he does, and often when I like hear his scores, he's kind of often just somehow in tune with what the character is feeling, instead of doing more of what most composers will kind of try to do, which is remind you what to feel. He's kind of just going for just kind of the general A, B, and C's that describe that person's mood. He likes to kind of draw like a squiggly line, but just with how that sounds, like you hear it kind of just intensifying throughout the scene, as opposed to just normally when you see or hear, you know, in this case, music composition, you're often kind of just restricted to like just one close up or one particular scene where you remember that. And he somehow has been fortunate enough to just kind of avoid having to deal with montage edits so much, you know.
Yeah, which used to be a staple of Wes Anderson, actually.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was Indie 101. Yeah. But it just, I mean, all these guys have like continually evolved so much, and he's been a mixture of both loyal to them as well as just working with new people who he hasn't worked with before. I mean, he did this one Ian McGregor movie that he starred and directed in. He's I actually do like his score for Suburbicon, even though that's a hit or miss satirical dark comedy about home invasions and house markets. But yeah, he's somehow, he's kind of immortalized in that he's done occasional TV, but not to the point where he's very reliant on it. And usually he's kind of already set for life. You're going to hear his score again more than you typically realize you hear it, because he's just worked with so many big names. But he's also, again, because he's often in it, something with a historical subtext and just all kinds of themes, he kind of makes everything his playground.
Yeah, and you know, outside of the Harry Potter movies, I don't know if he's gonna find another franchise where, you know, they're gonna tap him to do the whole thing. So you know, he's kind of on the A-list with, you know, like a Hans Zimmer, but he just doesn't have that name recognition. But like everyone has seen at least one movie where they're like, oh yeah, the score in that movie is great.
At this point, they've seen five of his movies, you know?
Yeah.
So it pretty much, I guess, if he's not going to be as big with a film buff, so who do you think he's probably the biggest with, other than, you know, anyone who attends the Cannes Film Festival?
Well, I mean, you've got your Harry Potter fans, right?
All right. So there you go. One giant franchise he really composed. And I guess if you're a fan of, again, definitely, you know, most of Wes and George Clooney's filmography, but then you're going to get some of these other guys. And I guess you could say he's second nature to them, especially if you're looking up what cinematographers, editors, and actors they often work with. He'll eventually come up in that realm. But yeah, I gotta say though, the Siriana score is really underrated. Like when people are crying in that movie, he uses just certain percussion that almost sounds like liquid is just like coming down, raining into the audience chamber, and he doesn't need any footage of actual weather to accomplish that. And yeah, with Wes, he kind of he makes use of, like you say, kind of like a lot of strings, and he's not going for, again, like you say, he's not trying to imitate Hans Zimmer, but he's also kind of trying to just, I guess you could say, be a noir kind of composer. I want to just do a character study and get you all stirred up by whoever you're watching for 2 hours.
Right. And, you know, and he can work kind of on a smaller scale with like Julia, and he can do a, you know, a bigger movie like some of these animated films that he's done, or
yeah,
like, I mean, a Twilight movie. It's pretty crazy. He
scored a cartoon show called Trollhunters, for God's sakes. You know, that's awesome.
Right.
Not what you would assume. So in a way, by the time anyone who has kids growing up, they will also be familiar with this material.
He's kind of sneaky in a sneaky way. He's kind of done the like the four quadrants thing. Like I've composed everything in each four of these quadrants, so at some point, as long as you like a movies, you're gonna hear something that I've done.
Nice.
He just needs to get into the MCU, I guess.
I am really actually surprised that he hasn't kind of joined the Alan Silvestris, Brian Tyler's, or Mark Mancina's of the world, who just stick with a particular genre or kind of movie. And it seemed like for a while, like people who were doing just like comedies would get a few drama cards once in a while. And then anyone who was doing like a mystery movie or some other big name, you know, psycho thriller, legal movie, got to do a action or horror movie. And yeah, he just keeps swerving around to where, aside from any genre being his pick, I think he's just, as long as he can illustrate where it needs to be, he's down for the count. He's down to do it. And
yeah, you know what he's doing next year, which is gonna definitely work their way into people's memories? The Barbie movie. He's doing that with Greta Gerwig, who he worked with previously on Little Women.
So there you go. And Asteroid City, I mean, that makes sense. It's another Wes joint. It's just so hard to describe his style, because it's like, it's different enough. But like you say, like, how do you introduce this to someone who's trying to get into all these film composers?
Well, I think he kind of fits between like the old school with like the John Williams and the Hans Zimmer, you know, kind of the people that
James Horner's, I guess.
Yeah, James Horner.
The ones who just, if they can't compliment whoever's crying on screen, whoever's running in slow motion, whoever is coming out of a damaged, you know, wreckage, you know, right, as well as illustrate just even little small cues, then they've already hung it up. But I think he's got an unusual amount of just like subtle energy. And he, instead of just building it up over time, he kind of focuses more on just like little small little ticks and like rising of volume, and then encapsulates it all together with like, it's kind of like hearing a ballet almost. And just in my mind, I just feel like he's dancing around on the keyboard and then eventually kaboom.
I think a ballet is a good way to
describe it.
But yeah, he's kind of between like this old school and this new school, where you have, you know, your Trent Reznors and your Johnny Greenwoods. And I feel like he's kind of the bridge between those two.
That's a good point, because Atticus and Trent are now especially doing, like you said earlier, heavy piano, and yet his piano though, it's interesting in that, like you say, it's just, it's not drastic dun dun, but it's also kind of a small melody. He resists the temptation to blend any rock or electronic tunes, and yet he's not just classical or orchestra based either. It's kind of a mixture, I guess, of kind of a let's say everyone's just hanging out at a random garden. he's kind of a mixture of an interactive live show and a recorded but very decorated group of settings that he's stapled together. He somehow is, I guess, he wants to basically be, I guess, whatever's in his head, as opposed to whatever he's influenced by, I guess.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I do feel like his scores do have a little bit of a dance sort of characteristic to it, you know, not like a going to the club and dancing, but, you know, like you were saying, like a ballet, like I definitely do feel like there's like a whimsical playfulness to a lot of his scores. And that's why I think I really like it. And they're also very melodic.
Absolutely. altogether, what scores would you recommend everyone check out more of?
I mean, you can't go wrong with his Oscar winning score for Grand Budapest Hotel.
Okay.
Sweet. I think that's my favorite of his. I have a film podcast friend, Lacey, who loves his score for Shape of Water. So I'll give that one a shit. He also won an Oscar for that, so I'll give that a shout out. Nice. You know, I'm a big Wes Anderson fan, so I'm a big fan of all the scores he's done for Wes, especially because I was a big Mark Mothersbaugh fan. So at first I was like, who's this Alexander guy?
Yeah,
why is this not guy? who's this guy?
What'd he do?
Why is he replacing him? But you know, he's won me over, and you know, he's a perfect fit for Wes. But, you know, like we said, he's a perfect fit for all of these directors that he's been working with. Like, he has a really good sense of how to make it work. Inevitably,
you're going to find some of these movies overrated or dull, but I can't say any of the scores just felt like they didn't belong in the movie, like they weren't good. So, I mean, if you're going to hate any of these movies for whatever reason, you can't say any of them aren't well shot or well staged, well scored or well acted. You know,
just, right.
He's fortunate enough to surround himself with a lot of talent, and he kind of complements each other. But man, I mean, this is really a blessing in disguise to just see this much talent branching out into all the corridors, all corners.
Right. Yeah. He's been able to work with a lot of A-list people, and there's a reason that he's sought after.
If you had the honor of working with him in some potential, I guess, what would you pick his brain about the most, I guess?
Just how he's able to balance all these different instruments. You know, like I said, with the piano, like he can use it as a lead instrument, but he's so good at just blending it with the rest of, you know, what he's doing. And I feel like that is so rare.
Yeah. everyone else wants to kind of dominate the scene, and he's really good at like just letting everything play out.
Yeah, and he doesn't need like a 100-person orchestra to get his point across.
Yes. Yeah. I saw that he had all kinds of training, but surprisingly, yeah, he could probably do it on his own self, kind of like some of these TV composers where he teaches himself an instrument. I was able to study some of the other guys like Kevin Kiner and W.G. Snuffy Walden, and they pretty much would get an orchestra and then toss it out and then get them back for a certain request and then go back to using the computer and other programming available. And like you say, he kind of just, he's adaptable. He's ready for any kind of challenge, as long as he gets the character's dramatic journey kind of demonstrated in a not so melodramatic way. And it's weird too, because like a lot of the World War II movies, especially Monuments Men and this one film, I think it's Alone in Berlin is what it's called. It's an Emma Thompson, Brendan Gleeson film. So there you go. He's working with more Harry Potter talent. But it's interesting how with those, yeah, he kind of goes for like some of the more minor cues that John Williams kind of similarly uses in Born on the 4th of July and Saving Private Ryan that somehow isn't very well used much in war movies. War movies often go for kind of a mixture of action or terror themes, and he kind of goes for more just like something as dramatic as seeing the sunset, where you know nothing good is going to happen around the corner, or kind of just reflecting again on the character's tough dilemma. And it's just interesting because I find that, unfortunately, and in some cases in a good way, everyone else kind of goes for the equivalent of a like hearing an explosion, but in music form. And he kind of goes for more, again, just subtleties and then just other kind of minor buildup. It's just, again, you know, just another rarity. And
right. Yeah. They're very, his scores are very human, you know, like you can tell, you can tell humans are playing those instruments, and you can, and I think he's attracted to like the human journey.
Yeah, I don't think that might even be why he got scared away. Because like, I know John Powell, of all people, mentioned at one point that he almost gave up composing because everyone wanted him to do mindless stuff, and he was like, "No, I'll do stuff that's exciting, but it's got to be dramatic. You know, it can't be." And so I know he did a few, like, I think he did a Fast and Furious movie, and then he did like a lesser a set of animated movies, but they weren't anything that like he wanted to do when he did stuff like Bourne Identity or Shrek or Ice Age. So it's interesting when you see people having to compromise whatever integrity mixed in with what they want to do versus what they don't want to do, and always trying to do their best job.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's so true. I don't think he's going to, you know, other than Harry Potter, I don't think he's sticking with franchises as much. But even then, I mean, that was a different kind of blockbuster franchise because it dealt with, again, a lot of suspense, a lot of people trying to trust each other in a difficult scenario, supernatural world that he had to, I think that's just it. He wanted to have it become humane, and that's just it. If people want to offer him something like an Expendables type movie, he's going to instantly say no, because he's just like, nah, it's just, I so that might be very well be it too. If he's going to do like maybe a Marvel or a DC movie, it better be a movie that's maybe has like two fight scenes and that's it. Like, it's got to be mostly dramatic or supernatural. It can't be
or it has to be some sort of like fantasy world.
Yeah, I mean, he did the Golden Compass, so I could totally see him doing a Buck. I mean, he did Valerian as well too, so I can totally see him doing a Buck Rogers Lord of the Ring type inspired or knockoff kind of movie. But I can't see him doing, and I mean, you mentioned Star Wars earlier, so there you go. If there's something, some kind of world he can actually build that's not mindless, he'll do it. But yeah, if it's gonna be the WWE is not going to be coming for him, is what I say. Like, he's kind of surprisingly stayed away from even just romantic comedies or even something dumb that might star someone like The Rock or Kevin Hart. He doesn't do slapstick. He doesn't do buddy movies. He doesn't do this and that. And I think that's just it. He kind of wants to go for, like, again, just natural stuff. Something as everyday as going to bed or opening your eyes. He wants to explore just everyday human behavior. He wants to just get right in there and make it stay with you after the credits have rolled. I will say it's definitely worth staying through the credits of some of his movies. You will definitely, for whatever reason, just feel like you're listening to just a classic record, except you don't have your record player out.
Yeah, and he was on the short list for the Best Original Song Oscar this year.
Oh, wow.
For Ciao Papa from Pinocchio. So, you know, he can write a song too. He doesn't sing it, but, you know, that's like the end credit song from Pinocchio.
Still, to come up with a song and give it to a established artist to sing, that's cool.
Yeah, and I actually was surprised it didn't make it to the to the Oscar nominations. But
was it streaming only, or did it play in some theaters?
I think everything that gets nominated has to be in theaters for at least one weekend, but it's on Netflix. I think Netflix is the production company.
Yeah, so there you go. He needs to avoid having people rely on Netflix marketing.
Yeah. And I think he's done some stuff with like Charlotte Gainsbourg and stuff as well, but I think they're all for like movies. He's not really going out and, you know, doing string arrangements for like for like popular artists or anything like that.
I could even see him doing working with someone else. I think he eventually might find Spielberg if he wants to do another dramatic piece. I can see him working with a Taika Waititi type, even though Taika's kind of mainly helming, you know, five different TV shows right now.
Right. I could see him working with Richard Linklater.
That's a good point. Yeah, Linklater, much like Anderson, goes for a lot of just, you know, just up close in person shots, and then kind of like early Spike Lee, he does like to kind of experiment with just like character narrating while they're acting out an action of some kind, and
or just 2 hours of people talking.
Yeah, 2 hours of people talking. he might even do a high school drama type movie, I can see.
Or if he wants to link up with his countryman, Michel Gondry, that they could do something fun.
He might even score one of the Avatar movies. Who knows? There's no telling. But he seems to be very agreeable because he just works with all these different names, but even though they're very different, they're very much alike in some capacity. So whatever presets he might be requesting or looking for and he's getting, they must all work in a similar manner. You
know? Yeah, I'm sure they give him a lot of
leeway
to do his thing. They know what they're getting when they hire him. And, you know, I feel like there's like a pretty consistent energy with a lot of these movies.
Yeah, there's never really anything, especially from any of the scores I heard even a few years ago on iTunes, I couldn't think of one that just, you know, like where I didn't see some kind of stick figures in my head, you know, walking down the, you know, down the streets, or even just scenes from the movies if I had seen them. I couldn't think of any that just, even in contrast, that like are only good if you listen to the movie. Somehow they kind of are able to ring out to where I remember them just as much as I remember the movie. I guess it's just, let's say you found said movie a little basic, then it might not stand out as much. But it still might intrigue you because it's kind of, again, you know, he's just got a human element to it.
Yeah, there, it's definitely like relaxing, you know.
Very relaxing. Yeah.
But not boring, you know, like.
No.
Like I said, they're all very melodic. He has a really interesting way that he uses instruments, and you know, they're very distinct. You can tell when it's one of his scores versus a different composer.
Yeah, I mean, if he were to ever go overseas and do some other kind of production, like do a Hong Kong production, do a Brazilian, you know, drama, you know, I could see him getting along very well with everyone. He seems to just want to know where it plays in the entire room as if it were an actual concert.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, no, I'm just another rarely agreeable dude. But yeah, thank you for joining me, Ryan. What do you have coming up that you would like to promote?
You know, we release episodes twice a month. We've got some fun episodes on like Kill Bill coming up.
Sweet.
Gross Point Blank.
There's some soundtracks too.
We're gonna talk about some of the Shrek movies.
Yeah.
So we've got a lot going on. You know, we didn't take a break. We just went into 2023 and started dropping episodes. So there's plenty to go back to. We just did an Eternal Sunshine episode for Valentine's Day, and
it's wonderful.
So yeah, we're releasing stuff, and you should check out our podcast.
All kinds of stuff, guys. Please check him out. Thanks for joining me.
And yeah, thanks for having me on. It's fun.
Absolutely. Anytime. Talk soon.
Yep.
We'll return after these messages.
Hello and welcome to Culture Shocked, the pop culture podcast brought to you by four aging millennials and our outdated opinions. Join us every Tuesday as we discuss movies, TV, games, and even music, new and old.
Dude, what do you think you're doing?
Are you seriously trying to record a promo without us right now?
Well, yeah.
Dude, you can't just do the promo by yourself. Who's going to listen to that?
Yeah, and you probably haven't even told them that we're a pop culture podcast where we always agree on everything. For instance, the Sam Raimi trilogy easily being the best of the Spider-Man movies.
No. But I think we can all agree that Jaws is a classical masterpiece.
Nope, don't like that. But we do all agree that the sequel trilogy of Star Wars is the best in the Skywalker saga, right, guys?
That comment is so ridiculous. I don't even know where to
Anyways, that'll do it from all of us here at Culture Shock. Thanks for listening.
Do you ever find yourself thinking about who would win in a fight between Goku and Superman? Hi, I'm James Gavsey, and on the Who Would Win show, me and my co-host Ray ignore anything important happening in the outside world and debate fictional battles between characters from comics, movies, and video games.
We got a new show every week, and almost always am I the winner.
Yeah, not true, Ray.
In the past, we've discussed such matches as Captain America versus Darth Vader, Solid Snake versus the Iron Giant, classic matchups like RoboCop versus Terminator, and even the Muppets versus Sesame Street.
That one was crazy. So if you're a fan of geek culture and love a spirited debate, check out the Who Would Win Show wherever you get your podcasts, or check us out at whowouldwinshow.com.
We let things pile up in the DVR, we add them to our queues, we wait for the DVDs and Blu-rays. We time shift. The Time Shifters Podcast. Sci-fi, horror, fantasy, superheroes, comedy, action, film, television, maybe some not-so-current events. Find us on iTunes or at timeshifterspodcast.com.
Cool thing about Blind Knowledge is we are in multiple countries. We are worldwide all across the globe. We are in the US, we are in the UK, we are in Canada, Germany, India, Japan, we're in Australia, y'all. BlindKnowledge.com. Now back to the feature presentation.
Dragon Ball Z, One Piece, Naruto, all things that we love, all manga that were originally published in the legendary magazine Weekly Shonen Jump.
But not every series can run for 300 chapters and have a hit anime. This is David.
This is Jordan.
We're the hosts of Shonen Flop. Each episode, we look at manga that ran in Jump that didn't quite make it.
We discuss what it did wrong, what it did right, how the series could have turned itself around, and ultimately, was it a flop or not?
Run all your favorite podcast apps, and you can find us at shonenflop.com.
Keep on flopping, floppers.
Follow us on the web on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The podcast is available on Podbean, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Anchor, Apple, and anywhere else podcasts are available. Feel free to review our show and leave comments on any of those sites. Thanks a million for listening. It's a jacked up.